Welcome to all to a rather abbreviated morning session, but we do have other matters and cases that we'll deal with. Day two, I'm honored to be sharing the bench with Judge Benavides and Judge Higginson. We have this one case for oral argument, United States versus Martinez-Flores. I think both of you are seasoned and familiar with our lighting system, so I won't belabor that point. We're ready for the court. The case, Ms. Leavitt, when you're ready.
May it please the court, Laura Leavitt for Mr. Martinez-Flores. This appeal concerns the application of the 16-level crime of violence enhancement in the guideline section 2L1.2 based on Mr. Martinez-Flores's New Jersey conviction for third-degree aggravated assault. The issue is whether the generic contemporary definition of aggravated assault encompasses New Jersey's definition of aggravated assault. The crux of the court's decision concerns whether New Jersey's definition of significant bodily injury substantially comports with or corresponds to the generic definition of serious bodily injury. The answer is no. And Ramirez's decision to the contrary was colored by the plain error review that applied there. The court stated specifically that at the beginning of its opinion, and it qualified its final decision as being one under plain error review. When the court reviews this issue de novo, it should come to an opposite conclusion. I'd like to just refresh the court's memory about the definitions at issue here. New Jersey defines its third-degree aggravated assault as intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly attempting or causing to attempt significant bodily injury. It has an aggravated assault that results in serious bodily injury. The injuries covered by significant bodily injury definition are temporary in nature. They are temporary loss of the function of a member of a body or organ, temporary loss of any one of the five senses. The model penal code definition, which is the model penal code, is the primary source for this court's definition of the generic aggravated assault, defines serious bodily injury in terms that are protracted injuries, permanent injuries. So it defines it as a bodily injury that creates a substantial risk of death, creates a permanent disfigurement, or a protracted loss or impairment of a bodily member or Oregon.
Beyond the semantics, you know, the definitions themselves, have you been able to see within the body of New Jersey law, I mean, actually examples, if you will, in other words, a broken arm is significant, an amputation, I mean, beyond the verbiage, you know, temporal, et cetera. I mean, do the New Jersey cases or anything implicate to say, when we say significant, we mean, you know, a heart transplant, whatever. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
That more graphically sort of not give a bright line, but gets us kind of out of is significant, serious, is very serious, close to significant. You follow what I'm saying?
I mean, Your Honor.
That gets to be a little troublesome. I mean, I was on the other Ramirez case panel, as you know well,
yes.
And I'm not pushing the point of whether it's plain error, but I read this and said this is deja vu all over again, because although we might have resolved this plain error, I remember getting down into this query about significant, serious, et cetera. So putting aside the fact it's a plain error, you know, I remember just having difficulty getting my arms around, you know, what do these words mean beyond just saying them? Do you follow me? So can
I
you
do,
help
Your Honor.
Any descriptively? Is there something
yes.
that helps us?
There is. There are several cases that do. And I'll say, for one, the Third Circuit decision in Horton, I'll just jump to that very quickly, because it notes the significant bodily injury in that case was a nosebleed. Horton is cited by the government for the has as an element test, which we can deal with in a moment. But an example of a serious bodily injury in the state law is a persistent bleeding as the result of a 1/2-inch throat slash that created a substantial risk of death for that particular victim, and you can see that in Turner, a case cited in my briefing. In James, the appellate court, New Jersey appellate court, looked to the New Jersey legislature for an example, and the New Jersey legislature said a significant bodily injury is impaired vision for a few days, whereas a serious bodily injury would be permanent vision loss.
Well, there was more language in James that's helpful on your part. It says, legislature enacted a third degree offense of aggravated assault because it intended to provide an intermediate level of assault which is more serious than simple assault and yet may not result in serious injury.
That is exactly right. New Jersey purposefully created this intermediate level of assault because it discovered that prosecutors were having very little success in convicting under its prior aggravated assault statute, the temporary loss type injuries that are now covered by the significant bodily injury. So prior to 1996, before the intermediate level was enacted, prosecutors were having little success. They were also unwilling to prosecute them as simple assault resulting in bodily injury. I do want to point to one more case, Your Honors, that show you the distinction between what would be a significant bodily injury and a serious bodily injury, and that is the case State v. Flynn, also cited in the briefing. And there you have four victims. Two victims suffered significant bodily injuries. Two other victims suffered serious bodily injuries. For example, the significant bodily injuries were a sprained neck, a forearm laceration. Opposite serious bodily injury was like a grade 2 liver laceration, fractures to the wrist, the forearm, the tailbone, the pelvic bone.
And so Flynn is an example of a least culpable act type conviction using third degree New Jersey aggravated assault. A sprained neck was an actual example?
It's an actual example of a significant bodily injury under New Jersey law.
But following the Supreme Court's instruction recently to us to look for the least culpable act that could be done, a sprained neck would say is the type of minor thing that would not fit in a common law aggravated assault?
Well, Flynn is a state case,
right.
And it's not. It is using more. That case involved, if I believe it was a habeas case, and it was dealing with. Can't remember if it had to do with an IAC claim and something, but it involved the description of the injuries in that case, which the prosecutor was describing them as such. But I could find no case that applies a categorical approach to the Supreme Court in its own case law in sufficiency of the evidence analysis.
Yeah.
It's just that I have found these examples of significant bodily injuries,
right,
under New Jersey law, and they are temporary in nature, don't last for a very long time.
The state descriptor, is it your position, the label, that has no significance?
No, as a matter of fact, the significant bodily injury sort of suggests on one level, if you're using a common language English usage dictionary, something more than what the actual definition shows. The actual definition shows that it's fundamentally different from the types of injuries that fall under serious bodily injury. The definitions themselves are stark, and New Jersey recognized that, as is other states. And when you put the definition of significant bodily injury under New Jersey law next to the definitions, the Model Penal Code, the supermajority of states,
I was going to ask you about that question.
I'm sorry, Steve.
You just said the supermajority of states, and I was going to. Frequently, we look to the Model Penal Code as a starting point, and I'm wondering what the other states do, because if most of the states don't follow the Model Penal Code, then I don't know whether that would be the right thing to look for the generic contemporary meaning. But you just said the majority of states, they require a permanent injury or life-threatening injury as opposed to just a serious bodily injury?
Or a protracted
loss,
or a protracted injury, or a serious disfigurement.
Where do we have, do you know where that, where is a case that says we've added it up and this is the supermajority? It's in your brief?
I did that in the appendix,
yeah.
And I noted the slight variations, but when you look at the 43, six states that I say that are either following exactly the Model Penal Code definition of serious bodily injury or substantially comport with it, you see that those injuries that are covered are either life-threatening or protracted in nature, requiring extensive medical treatment.
Part of my inquiry is, because you know we are here on these issues over and over again, I still don't for sure understand if the Supreme Court is directing us. You said the Model Penal Code is the primary source. Do you have an authority for that, or I may ask the opposing counsel too, the supermajority mechanism, is there any authority for why even that is the approach, as distinct from Black or Lefebvre?
I base that supermajority on the Supreme Court's instruction in Taylor, and it clearly said that it looks to the majority of states' codes to decide whether in that case basic elements. The Model Penal Code comes from this court's decision in Torres v. Diaz and its progeny, and it cites the Model Penal Code as one of the primary sources. Right. You can look to Black's Law Dictionary, but...
Well, it also says contemporary meaning, so that would suggest to me what it means right at the present time, and it seems like if nearly all the if you combine the word generic with contemporary, it would envision, if all the states are doing it, or nearly all the states, that's a pretty good indication of generically in the modern world, that's where we're at right now.
I agree. But I do want to say one thing. I believe that the best way to determine, and this is my belief based on Taylor, the Supreme Court's decision in Taylor, the best way to determine what the generic definition of an offense is to go through the state's statutes and case law. It's intensive, but that tells you exactly what the broad range of states are doing, what the basic elements are, not maybe in fine-tuned, but what the basic elements of a generic offense are. And then you say, does it comport? But other sources, such as the Lefebvre Model Penal Code, not so much the Model Penal Code at all the time, but with respect to aggravated assault, tends to support what the majority of states are doing.
Let me ask you a question. On one side, you have a distinction between serious, which is permanency, is according to your view, and some kind of significant injury that's different from just any kind of injury or harm or touching or whatever. So that informs on your side. On the other side, you have the fact that the legislature in New Jersey also distinguishes, by doing that, they also distinguish between just a regular simple assault and what they decided is an aggravated assault. In other words, it depends on which level, where you're coming from. If you're coming from the right side, well, you say, well, that, when we're looking at aggravated assault, then it's got to be serious. If you come from the other side, you say, well, aggravated assault is something that's not a simple assault. And the legislature has chosen to take these offenses and say, these are not simple assaults. These are aggravated assaults.
I think the premise is, I would agree if what you're saying is that out of bodily injury, which is rather a broad definition, they increased it to a little higher level, but they didn't go way up there to serious bodily injury. And I think you can see that from the definition of bodily injury in the guidelines, although it's not the primary source or anything. But interestingly, they define bodily injury as any significant injury, painful, obvious, or something that would require medical attention.
Well, if you look at the actual indictment in this case, it suggests, I mean, if you practice law in the state courts, you know, he's indicted for using something, a broken glass, which would be like a dangerous weapon, and causing injury, which would fit if he'd have pled guilty to that. And he winds up pleading to something that doesn't require either a dangerous weapon, and there's never any allegation that with respect to permanency or anything like that. And so you don't really know what happens, but even if you look in the context of what happened, that suggests that either he didn't use this dangerous weapon or instrument that was dangerous, or the level of seriousness wasn't such that it was still a larger offense.
I agree. I just do want to clarify that the indictment doesn't allege a dangerous weapon as the aggravator. It did serious bodily injury, and he was charged with, my client was charged with two other people. It's not clear who actually did the deed in that case. So, and we don't even really know what kind of injury was involved. We know there was a stabbing, but we can't look to those facts. Our analysis is limited to the plain
Judge
language.
Kittmer did look at Ramirez closely, and he pointed out that even under plain error, when it's a question of statutory interpretation, you're not giving much more deference. Do you have a thought on that?
I'm sorry, repeat that. I didn't quite
Judge Hittner largely made the sentence he made by referencing our Ramirez decision. And he pointed out during sentencing that even if it is a plain error case, it's still a question of statutory interpretation. So plain error wouldn't have altered the deferential approach.
Well, I with all due respect, it does, because the opinion doesn't reveal, although it may have happened, there was no oral argument, there was scant briefing, that they went into the detail that I've gone into and showed the very major differences between the two levels of injury and that the case law under New Jersey law shows.
That it was plain. You don't know whether it was done because it was no error or because it wasn't plain error.
That's correct. The opinion is not clear on that.
All right.
I see that my time is up.
All right. Thank you. So you saved time for the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson?
May it please the court. I'd like to discuss why this court's decision in Ramirez is sound and why the district court properly applied it. As you just pointed out, Judge, virtually every, it is a question of law, a question of statutory interpretation. We're talking about the identical statute, 1B7 in New Jersey. And here, Martinez Flores has largely raised the same arguments that Judge Stewart and the panel disagreed with. Now, in a nutshell, we're essentially seeking to relitigate Ramirez, but the fact that it was under plain error should be of no real consequence. It's well established that even in the context of plain error review, the error prong is considered de novo. And that's exactly what this court did in Ramirez. There's no indication, there's no suggestion that the court circumvented certain steps. Instead, as Judge Hinojosa recognized, and as the opinion clearly shows, it was a very considered and thorough evaluation. The court first applied all the applicable crimes of violence principles, if you will, and then moved in to analyze the particular statute in question, which of course is the same exact one we have here. And once it did so, it stopped at the first prong. So in other words, it determined that absolutely no error had occurred. And there's tremendous value in that in relation to this case.
It didn't say that. It says there was no plain error.
Well, what the court found in its interpretation was that based on the statutory provision that there was the statute fell within if you will, the enumerated crime of violence.
Well, that was the conclusion, but it wasn't the statement of the court that there's no error necessarily. They did highlight that they didn't conclude there was plain error. We don't know which of the four elements, especially as they point out without oral argument.
Well, and I don't mean to mislead the court with that, but when my perception, or actually not my perception, but my evaluation of the step-by-step reasoning of the court is that is what it determined. And not to be disrespectful or what have you, but there was no indication there was a problem. As I said in my brief, and of course, as this court knows, and Ms. Leavitt, the court clearly said it was under plain error. It said that in the beginning of the opinion, and it said that at the bottom.
For my sake, start with just the merits. It does seem like a difficult proposition to assert that this distinction, difference between temporary and permanent injury, isn't fundamental. When I read the New Jersey cases, they describe it as fundamental and critical, and somewhat to my surprise, it doesn't seem to be a slight difference. It seems to be one that Black, the Model Penal Code, and even federal statutory law, when I went to Chapter 7 in Title 18, which is our federal equivalent, and you go to 113, assaults in federal jurisdiction, it's exactly the difference between significant and serious. They all seem to point to this difference between a temporary physical injury and a permanent one.
So right, but as the court said in Ramirez, they're alike in relation to their, they have a similar intent, But the difference was, as you point out, the serious or the degree of, let's say, bodily injury. And in Ramirez, this court found that this slight imprecision didn't take it out.
What I'm saying,
no, it didn't say that it did. It said it would not preclude the court from finding a sufficient equivalence. It wouldn't, that wouldn't preclude it from finding it.
Well,
that's the difference from saying we find that it is. And then ultimately, when it makes its decision, it says on plain error review, the difference in this case between significant bodily injury in New Jersey is not enough.
And I recognize
plain error review.
And I recognize, I mean, I fully disclosed that as the prosecutor did, the trial prosecutor did, to Judge Hinojosa. However, what we're still looking at is statutory interpretation of the same exact statute. Now, in Bailey, another case,
okay, the statutory interpretation that we said in that case is that the difference is it would not preclude us from making that finding, but we didn't make it. Wouldn't keep us from doing it, but it didn't say that's what we did.
Well, but this case is no different. It's the same exact statute. Now, I realize the standard of review.
Let's say I said, you know, I could make this decision in this case. It's a statutory review and says, you know, the fact that it's this way doesn't keep me from making a decision in this case. Is that the same thing as saying the differences here causes me to make this decision in this case? In other words, you're saying it's the same case, but the actual words of the court using is not a finding. It's just saying that wouldn't preclude us from making this finding. It doesn't say we make this finding.
However, in interpreting 1B7 in Ramirez, which is the same exact statute here, this court did not find error. Now, I realize what you're saying, Judge, but I have to agree with Judge Hinojosa in this.
Well, of course you have to agree.
Because I do think that, but I do think.
Getting away from Ramirez and whether it locks us down, I think the phrase you used is the operative one. Is this a, quote, slight imprecision?
That's
where did you get that from?
I believe that was in Ramirez. It's been in some other cases, and I'd like to briefly mention your decision in Esperanza, where you found that, or the panel found rather, that there was no underlying assault in that. I mean, the Arkansas statute did not have the requisite elements, and it contrasted that with Ramirez and some other decisions where the statutes fell within the common meaning and finding that Arkansas was significantly different. And what you have here, as you mentioned in relation with Ms. Leavitt, was something, you know, you have the simple assault and there's degrees. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have a simple assault here. We have something more. We have at least significant.
But we just were reversed 8-1 by the Supreme Court in Moncrief.
I understand.
And the Supreme Court said, look, as I read it, look for the least culpable possible description of the offense that you're looking at. So if Ms. Leavitt's right, that you can commit third-degree New Jersey aggravated assault by spraining someone's neck, as distinct from permanent laceration of their liver, that's not a slight imprecision. That's an enormous gulf. And it turns out what I said, I think I'm right. Tell me if I'm wrong. The sources we're being told to look at, Black, the federal analog, 113, they all describe this as a major distinction, a fundamental distinction, not a slight imprecision. Do you disagree with the fact that the Black or 113 point this out as a major distinction?
Well, I think there's a wealth of authority out there from this court and elsewhere. And sometimes it's very hard to, let's say, rationalize the cases or to actually dice them. This has been,
Let's assume all our cases are not so helpful. Just focus on the sources that the Supreme Court keeps telling us to focus on. Is this a distinction that is more than a slight imprecision in Blacks, yes or no?
Well, Blacks has different versions of the statute, And as I recall, one that the one that I did see, it talks about assault, and then he moves over to aggravated assault, and it talks about something. This is from memory, something more serious. And one of the examples is it uses, as I recall, an intent to commit an additional crime or serious bodily injury. It might even have an EG with it. This is off the top of my head. Okay. So in that case, yes, we're moving across the border, or the, you know, we're moving across the line, if you will. Where do you stop? I think that's essentially what you're asking me. And those questions get very difficult, but what we're talking about is essentially, is this an assault or is it an aggravated assault, correct? I mean, I realize it's an enumerated crime of violence. I do understand that. But if it's not an aggravated assault, that leaves it at what? Just a general assault, correct?
Well, as Judge Benavides pointed out, New Jersey's legislature explains they wanted something intermediate. They want,
right.
That to me means they wanted something other than an aggravated assault, as it's generically and commonly known. And then
they took the statute that really fits the model penal code.
I understand.
And they said, we want to have another offense that's not the model penal code.
Yeah.
So it's hard to look at the model penal code and say it's the same or equivalent if the legislature thought, we're not getting enough convictions here. We've got to make it so it covers other things that aren't covered by the a statute that's a model penal code. And to say that when they did it, and then you don't have the serious nature, that didn't create something that was distinct from what they already had before. If they wanted the model penal code, they could have just kept it the way it was.
Well, and Judge Stewart and his panel pointed that out in Ramirez. I mean, clearly New Jersey recognized a legal difference. There's no question about that, based on whether it's a second degree or third degree offense. And of course, he was originally charged under B1, which was the serious one, as you pointed out, and then he pled out to the lesser included offense. But if this court is going to continue to adhere to the fit doesn't have to be precise, which is it's
well, wait a minute. There's a difference between the fit doesn't have to. What if the fit is not precise, and it also would violate what the Supreme Court tells us to do? It says use the least culpable situation in assessing whether it fits into this category or not. I mean, what do we do? I mean, if the courts in New Jersey have told us that this is what they wanted to do, and they didn't want to have something that was permanent or serious, and then you say, well, it doesn't make any difference if they don't want it to be permanent or serious. It's close enough to permanent or serious, to serious bodily injury, even though that's what they wanted to get away from.
I personally don't think that's my opinion, but I try to adhere to y'all's precedents. But, you know, again, and another example is the Esparza, where you said, and where the court said, rather, that the Arkansas statute was significantly different. So is it significant, substantial, slight precision? Obviously, that's this court's role. I would argue that this is a far cry from a simple assault. I understand that New Jersey came back and said, right, let's segregate this offense in relation to a significant and a seriousness. I understand that. I mean, that's clear. I don't think anybody disputes that, including Judge Hinojosa. Mm-hmm. So the question is very simple. Maybe the answer is not. But the question is significant enough to be aggravated?
To be aggravated, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or are you going to say, well, significant really doesn't mean much at all, so we're going to just push it back to a simple assault?
Do you agree with her appendix that the vast majority of states seem to be saying it's a significance with a significance?
Well, yes, but I don't think you can take these, you can't necessarily take these, and this analysis in a vacuum. And this court has said that repeatedly. So you look to Blacks, or you look to the model penal code, or you look to these statutes, or you look to the elements. And so another way to resolve this case is an element of force.
Okay, the catch-all.
Yeah, because it's yes.
But we got a problem in our circuit because of our case law on what with respect to element of force.
Yes, and of course the third way to resolve it, and of course.
Let's stay on that one for a minute. Do you agree with Judge Benavides' position that Calderon-Pena forecloses the catch-all position, the element of force, the current en banc position of this court?
Well, I would never disagree with an en banc opinion.
But no, but do you interpret that en banc opinion to make the argument in this case difficult?
It is difficult. However, the Third Circuit in Horton, of course, found that it was an element of force.
Yeah.
And that's the New Jersey court, if you will. I mean, you know where the New Jersey cases go. And a third reason to affirm, admittedly a little more difficult, however, is the harmless error approach. Because Judge Hinojosa was adamant that this court understand his sentencing decision. However, he did not say that he had not considered the guidelines, but of course he talked about Martinez Flores's violent criminal history and gang membership and all those lines.
Judge Hinojosa, though, knows that the wording has to be clear, and he's got to say, independently, I would be here.
Yes.
And I know he yes. was concerned about this defendant, but I don't see
yes.
him ever saying that.
Well, as the longest-serving member of the Sentencing Commission, Judge Hinojosa certainly knows that he could have insulated it by saying, even but for the 16-level enhancement, I would give this sentence. I mean, that's the most. I don't know anybody that knows more about sentencing
well, that's,
than Judge
Hinojosa. That's right, and that's why it was so peculiar, because he went on and on about his particular sentence.
Yeah.
And I cited that case along the lines of you don't have to necessarily say the magic words, although, yes, I agree, you would expect Judge Hinojosa, of all people, to say that very thing. But returning back, what we have to have is, in this court's jurisdiction, is, again, that it has to be close enough. And I'm using my words just in general. And so, again, if the court's choice is one of two, essentially pushing it to a simple assault or some kind of catch-all there, or finding that it truly is aggravated. And I think when we look at what's out there in this regard, it is a sound decision.
What if close enough would include some offense that's not close at all?
Somewhat, I'm sorry?
What if,
some offense, is that what you said?
Yes, what if close enough, the definition is close enough, that but nonetheless, under that close enough definition, it would include some injuries that clearly wouldn't fit into serious bodily injury, that wouldn't fit into the model penal code, that wouldn't fit into...
I understand that. Well...
I mean, we've got to look at all the circumstances.
Well, I think what this court has done, not just in Ramirez and other cases, though, it's looking at the model penal code and these other secondary sources, if you will, in conjunction with the wording of the statute. And there's plenty of law that says if it falls way outside or it's outside, it doesn't count. Esperanza's a perfect case with that Judge Higginson wrote where it said that it was substantially different. Mm-hmm. So it's going to always depend upon the statutory interpretation in conjunction with these secondary sources. And the easiest, I think it's still sound, the Ramirez analysis, whether you use it as a guidepost or something like that, but it's the exact same statute. And again, we're talking about whether it's aggravated, as opposed to just some general out there. And of course, in this case, the guy got stabbed with a beer bottle. So, there's nothing in there about what his particular injuries are. And I know we don't really necessarily go there, but we have been having a discussion about typical injuries. And so, I think Judge Stewart was right. I don't know if Judge Stewart still shares his opinion.
Pull me back into it.
But
I think that decision was right too. That doesn't mean that it controls this case.
I don't think you need to hook your main frame onto whether that plain error case is. You ought to be able to tell you probably. I would, even if I agreed with you, you might surmise I'd be outvoted on that. So, as Judge Higginson said, probably here. But in fact, I mean, even assuming, I don't think the Ramirez, you know, business, we're still back to where we start with this statute. I mean, in fact, as we all seem to be constantly in circles, you know, with these kinds of assignments. And then, of course, even that, as Judge Higginson points out, it predates, you know, Moncrief and us getting some guidance. So even if it did have some persuasive value, even I would question how far that goes as far as the analysis here. So I don't know.
Well, all I can request is that you hang tough.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Mongia Portilla, is that how you pronounce it?
I'm sorry?
The case you cite, Mongia Portilla, is that?
Oh.
The one about mental states not being more than slight imprecision?
Yes.
Tennessee aggravated assault? You remember
yes.
that? Okay. In that one, my memory is we said, oh, well, thank goodness Tennessee's aggravated assault has the serious bodily injury quality. Do you remember this or not?
Okay, vaguely, so, truthfully.
Okay. It was just another one of our graspings, and as you point out, in the opposite way with Esparza, that might have been an example of where we're distinguishing it, saying, well, it's got to have that serious bodily injury element. That's the real definer for aggravated assault.
But, of course, you also cited Ramirez, and I don't want to continue to quibble over this. I mean, we all know our different positions and whatnot.
Well, at best, all you can say is that, you know, Ramirez is maybe persuasive to some degree or another, but it's, to me, it's still not going to be dispositive.
Well, and I said, I also said that it should be, you know, a guidepost or something like that. But the fact of the matter is the court continued to apply what I call the Ramirez principles in Bailey, which, of course, was under plain error review. And Esparza, and it's been picked up, as I think, from in a couple other decisions. But I see that my time is up, and unless you have any other questions.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your briefing and your assistance. Ms. Levitt, back to you on rebuttal.
I'd like to direct this court's attention to Dominguez-Ochoa. In that case, both dealt with causing the death of the homicide offenses dealt with causing the death of another. The question before the court was whether Texas criminally negligent homicide, negligently causing the death of another, was he subsumed within or substantially comported with generic manslaughter, that is, recklessly causing the death of another. And the court said no. The mens rea requirement was a fundamental material difference that took the Texas criminally negligent homicide offense outside the family of manslaughter offenses. And the degree of difference in that case is comparable to the, in our case, is comparable to the degree of difference in that case.
Let me ask you a straight up question. Put aside the Ramirez issue. What is it you would articulate is the fine-tuning holding that this panel ought to issue in this case about this statute?
That significant bodily injury is not encompassed with, does not overlap with, the generic contemporary definition of serious bodily injury that comprises one of the basic aggravators of aggravated assault. And all sources that this court looks to for the generic contemporary meaning of it, starting with a survey of the states, looking to the model penal code, even looking to Black's Law Dictionary, says that that's the correct decision. It follows Taylor's guidance in determining what a generic offense from the get-go is, and when comparing it to a state offense and whether the state offense comports with it. It also incorporates the Moncrief decision that has instructed, which this court has done anyway.
It would be significant as stated and as interpreted by the New Jersey courts, because we don't know how another court, another legislature is going to define significant, and
well,
we don't know how the other courts in that state are going to look at significant. So we don't have to go that far.
That's not this case.
Yeah.
That's correct. And so far...
What about
far,
the Third Circuit? Horton, she points out that New Jersey's within the Third Circuit.
But the Third Circuit has never followed this court's Vargas-Duran, Calderon-Pena has as an element test. It has always looked at causing bodily injury as having the use of physical force, but Vargas-Duran clearly instructed that's not the case.
That's some intuitive appeal. I know we're not arguing that issue. Can I just ask you one question in that regard? How are we a minority of one in Calderon-Pena? Are all the other circuits looking at it the way the Third Circuit is?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't believe we're alone, but I'd have to do...
Our vote was very close in that en banc.
Right. But it is the correct vote. Causing a bodily injury, you could do it without the use of physical force. You could tell somebody to please back up, I want to take your picture, and he falls off a cliff and dies or breaks a leg. I mean, you just don't have to do these injuries. I know that's hypothetical in my little world right now,
yeah,
but that is causing serious bodily injury or causing the death of another without actually using physical force against that person.
Well, you could tell somebody to take a medicine that's laced with a chemical, and you don't use any force.
Correct. And when legislatures know how to say we're going to.
We've had enough time that has passed by that if the Sentencing Commission and the Congress wanted to do something about it, they could have done something.
States know how to define using physical force. By stabbing, by hitting, they include those elements. I do want to say one thing before I forget. This case, my client's been in custody since July 20th of 2010. I believe the four-level enhancement applies, but even if the eight-level enhancement applies, he would have at most gotten 30 months, and he would have already been released from imprisonment.
Well, I don't know whether Judge Hinojosa would.
I trust Judge Hinojosa. As you said, he does this in every sentencing hearing. He starts and says, this is how I'm going to do the sentence in this case. I'm going to make sure the guidelines are correctly calculated. I'm going to look at the relevant factors. I'm going to listen to the parties. And then I'm going to find the appropriate sentence. And then I'm going to ream the defendant out and based on whatever his history is. And that's what he does from my anecdotal
review. That's a good point. But no one's moved to expedite this appeal.
Well,
am I wrong?
You're correct, Your Honor. I'm asking you now
this point,
in this situation to please. Yes.
Okay.
Well, I asked you to give us the holding, so all we got to do is go.
Yes, please do, Your Honors. I ask that you do that and vacate and remand.
Send you home with it. It's not likely.
I would appreciate that.
I don't think that's going to happen. But
these
are tough issues, to put it mildly. We seem to just constantly be into this arena. But that said, we appreciate the good advocacy of both sides, you know, with these cases as we try to write with some degree of precision in terms of whatever we say. That said, the case will be submitted and we'll give it our best shot.
I appreciate y'all staying on point and having competent people talking about issues that they know something about.
Oh,
so
thank you. We appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. No doubt we'll have this issue again. We stand in recess.